So, here on our first day of our retreat, thinking about what might be nice to discuss or to for you to hear, I thought of sharing with you a particular sutta from the Middle Length Discourses. It's called the Simile of the Cloth, Sutta 7. And it's a discourse that I'm very fond of. It's meaningful for me, and I hope that as we start this retreat and as we go along, that maybe this is meaningful for you as well. And as an introduction to the text, two things to say. One is that this is the sutta where the Buddha gives the instruction to a particular person, a Brahmin, to make yourself a refuge for all beings. And that resonates. It's kind of very nice. That sits in my heart very well, this idea of making yourself a refuge for all beings, support for all beings. So I'll describe that. And then the sutta also has a term. In Pali it means, in Pali the word is avecha pasada. And pasada is a word that is very closely akin to the English word faith, though translators often will translate it. Some people translate it as faith. Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as confidence. Some people translate it as trust. But it's related to the word for serenity or clarity, to be clear light or peaceful kind of way of being. So sometimes it's referred to as tranquil faith as opposed to fiery faith or zealot faith or something. So I'm happy enough with the word faith myself, because it's kind of, for me, faith is an aspect of the heart, not of belief. It's where I can put my heart into, or what I can give myself over to wholeheartedly is what I have faith in. But the first word, avecha, Bhikkhu Bodhi translates as unwavering confidence. And in doing so, he is going along with the commentaries, how they refer to the word. But the word avecha is a particular grammatical form of the word vidya. Some of you know avidya means ignorance. Vidya means to know, knowledge. And the Vedas in ancient texts means the kind of knowledge or wisdom. And so it kind of uses an adjective for the word faith. And I think what it means, and you'll see as we go through the sutta, that it means faith based on knowledge. Or one of the dictionaries translates as confirmed faith. But you know, the word comes from knowledge, so it's kind of based on knowledge, something you know, then you have faith, as opposed to having faith because you believe what someone tells you or something. And I think this pointing to this idea of confirmed faith, or faith based on knowledge, or trust based on knowledge, is hopefully something we're coming to as we practice. We're getting ourselves to know something that's very meaningful enough in our own experience that it gives us confidence, some deep abiding trust in the practice, in ourselves, in life, some faith. And in such a way, and this is what Sutta talks about, that it gives us joy. Lee this morning talked about the absence of the hindrances bring gladness. And this sutta, also talks about the gladness that comes from this kind of faith. And then follows a little bit the same unfolding, and different way of describing it as Lee was talking about. And so it's one of the reasons I wanted to give this talk, was to tie it into what he mentioned this morning. But before we get into the sutta itself, I thought we would do a little, I'd offer you a little guided meditation. Maybe it'd make up for this morning. Not really. I just sometimes can't resist joking around, sometimes to my detriment. It was great this morning. So, if you want to take probably about 5 minutes or so. So why don't you get yourself into a little bit more of a posture of meditation. And gently close your eyes. And perhaps gently enter into your body to first familiarize yourself with what it feels like to be in a body, what it feels like, your body feels right now. And then if you can take a few moments to make maybe some very subtle adjustments of your body so that maybe your body can be a little bit more comfortable. Remembering that being comfortable might also mean a little bit more energized or upright, alert. Doesn't necessarily only mean being relaxed. And to help with this settling in process, it can be helpful to take a few long, slow, deep breaths. Can be nice sometimes with a deep in-breath to feel it almost like a massage from the inside that's stretching you and moving you, your rib cage, your shoulders, back rib cage. And then the exhale, all those areas relax and soften. And then letting your breath return to normal. It can be also helpful to scan through your body to see if there's any obvious places of holding that you can relax in your body. You might be able to relax around the forehead and the eyes, the jaws, the shoulders, and soften maybe the area of your shoulder blades. And perhaps it can be helpful to soften the belly, letting the belly hang forward and down. And then feeling the contact of your body against the chair or the floor or the cushion. And as you exhale, release yourself a little bit to the pull of gravity. Such a way you're more grounded and present here. And now I'm going to ask you to do something which is maybe very different than you've done so far today. I'd like to ask you to let yourself think as you wish, let thinking happen. And as you're thinking, know that you're thinking. Observe the fact that you're thinking. Not so much that you're thinking about thinking, but you could even know what you're thinking about because you're mindful of the event of thinking. This amazing process. It's kind of a miracle that 5 billion years of evolving universe should bring us to have our thoughts. So and I'm going to ask you, so they might wander away, and that's okay, and then just maybe just go with your breath, and then they come back. Then for the little while, we're going to study your thinking. So the first thing I'd like to ask you is, as a thinker, when you think, do you think more in images or more in words? How do you usually think? More in images or in words? Is there an inner voice that speaks? Or is there kind of a screen or stage upon which images are visualized? And some people have a little bit of both, depending on the situation. Whatever seems accessible now, notice it for you now. And then if you can, see if you can notice the location where you're thinking. So for example, if you're thinking in images, is there some place where the mind's eye sees them? Is there a location, a place, a screen upon which they appear? Or if you think in words or have an inner voice, is there a place where the speaker is, the inner mouth, or the speakers that project the voice? There's no right or wrong place. Some people at first have trouble finding a place, but then I'll ask them, is it a location in your little toe or in your kneecap? And they usually they say no. And then they realize, well, actually, they can kind of narrow the range of location to some smaller place, some subsection of the universe of their body or something. Do you think mostly above your waist, below your waist, above the neck, below the neck, above the eyes, below the eyes? So as you're thinking, and you're welcome to choose some you think about even, notice if you think in words or in images. Some people think in texts, so it's kind of a combination of both. Texts kind of appear in front of them. And be aware of the location, like it's happening, like a particular place, kind of like you step back and look, kind of like you're at a movie theater, absorbed in the movie. It's so exciting what's going on in the screen. But then the person next to you starts chewing popcorn really loud and doing something, and you kind of wake up from the movie and you realize you're in a movie theater and there's lights flashing on the screen and people around you, and you're kind of aware that, oh, it's just a movie, and in a movie there aren't really people up there on the screen. You kind of step out of the absorption in the movie for a little bit. The same way, can you step out of involvement with your thinking and just see it as energy, as phenomena, arising and passing, just being there on the screen or being projected from the speakers? What happens to your thinking when you, in a sense, step back from it and observe it, see it? See it as a phenomena, as something happening now, just thoughts. And as you observe your process of thinking, what is the general mood or emotional state of those thoughts? If it's in words being spoken, what's the tone of that inner voice? If it's movie that you see, images, is there a mood that goes along with them? And as you stay with your, as you're able to stay aware and present for your thinking, when it comes up, when it's there, can you notice what your involvement with your thinking is? And what's the glue or the force of attraction between you and your thoughts? Are the thoughts just kind of lightly floating and appearing, and you can take them or leave them? You hardly care? Or is there a lot of interest? Are you kind of, do you kind of get pulled into them and gripped by them, or you grip them? You find yourself being really close to them, so close that you are your thinking? Or are you kind of a little bit more spacious around the thoughts? You're not, the thoughts are not really who you are. They don't define you. They're just thoughts that come and go. How close are you? How are you involved with them? And then as you watch your thinking, as you're mindful and aware of thinking going on, experiment now for just a little bit to have your awareness of thinking be relaxed. Be open, relaxed, allowing, no big deal. Just aware. And for just the last moments of this exercise, see if you can find a way or notice that if you kind of step back or open up or be spacious with your attention, your awareness, that maybe awareness is a little bit peaceful, maybe a little bit not caught by attachments or greed or fear or aversion. There's a simplicity. Simple simplicity and to just being aware. Just knowing what's happening, knowing your thinking. That's distinct from the thinking itself. So then to end this exercise, you can take a few long, slow, deep breaths. Feel your body. Feel connected to your chair or the floor, the cushion. And then when you're ready, if you'd like, you can open your eyes. One way of describing the adventure, the journey of practice is that it involves clarifying and freeing the relationship we have with our experience, with whatever is going on. We're almost always in relationship to what's happening. And most simply way of saying that is to say we always want, almost always, we want or we don't want something. But sometimes it takes all kinds of other forms. Sometimes not just wanting, it's you know, there's greed involved. Or it's not just not wanting, there's aversion, ill will involved. Or it gets more complicated and there can be things like envy and jealousy or rivalry or being in conflict or resisting and, you know, what's going on. We have a relationship to what is. So if your knee hurts, it's not just the knee pain floating out in space and isn't that nice, but rather there's maybe resistance to it, aversion to it, self-pity, fear, all kinds of things. We're in relationship to it, and or there's good feelings that arise in sitting and practicing perhaps, and it's nice to have. It's good to support it and maybe let it grow and develop. But there's also can be a lot of conceit related to it. Look at me, I hope everyone's noticing. You know, I'm really kind of cooking here. And that's, we're in relationship to what's going on. So same thing with our thinking. We can be in relationship to our thoughts. And some people are so wedded or so embedded in their thinking, never occurs to them. Thinking just is. That's one of the relationships, is to be completely lost in the movie, caught up in the movie. Or we believe our thoughts, or we're invested in our thinking because we think our thinking is where we're going to solve all our problems if we just think them out long enough. So we have a relationship to them. And as we kind of wake up more in practice, we begin to let go of some of the unnecessary ways in which we are relating to our experience. And so we're freeing ourselves up from being entangled, being caught, being attached, in all the different ways we can be attached. Or as the Second Noble Truth refers to it, there's thirsting going on. There's craving going on that's somehow supposed to represent the whole gamut of these complicated relationships we have. And so, I don't know if you could do this with this exercise and on thinking. I did it for a number of reasons. Some people have never looked carefully at the whole phenomenon of thinking. They've let go of it, they let go of it, or they noted thinking. But to really take time, and it's one of the great wonders of the world, thinking. It's well worth being a naturalist and studying it and getting to know it. And as we get to know the whole, all the different dimensions of thinking, all the dimensions of thinking which are independent from the content of what we think, there's so much going on there. Then we can start kind of stepping back or not being kind of lost in it and caught up in it, and kind of maybe more spacious around it, or more, in the best possible senses of the term, detached from it. You know, just kind of not the knowing quality, the awareness of the mind, the attention quality of the mind, can feel independent of it, can feel untroubled by it. And even better is sometimes when the awareness and knowing that we of whatever's going on is feels like it has a kind of relief or peace or ease to it that's independent of what we're paying attention to. So, for example, I could be angry, and if I'm embedded in my anger, then my awareness is kind of suffused with that anger. It's kind of hard to see it separate from my, I'm just aware in an angry way. The mood of awareness is kind of angry. But if I can really clearly see, now I'm angry, kind of step back and really see it, not only is it possible to be a little bit detached from it, but then the anger doesn't have to suffuse and color the mood of consciousness, of awareness itself, of what we know. And you can actually feel and know, in the knowing of the anger, that knowing itself is not angry. Is that making a little bit of sense? No. Hopeless? Oh well. So that's okay. So I will, this is also kind of a way of, kind of as a lead segue into this sutta. So now I'll tell you the sutta. So one aspect of this is the Buddha is sitting at the edge of a river. And it's a river, kind of a sacred river in India, where people believe that if you went to this river, it would wash your sins away, that the river would actually liberate you if you kind of went washing in it. And so this Brahmin who believes this asks the Buddha, are you going to go swimming in, are you going to go bathing in the river, in the sacred river? And the Buddha says, what can that river do for me? Why should I? And the Brahmin says, many people believe that this river gives liberation. They believe it gives merit, and it will wash away your evil actions. So that's a great promise. And the Buddha doesn't buy it. And he says, believing that these sacred rivers can do all these things, a fool may there, in those rivers, forever bathe, yet will not purify their dark deeds. What can these rivers do? They cannot purify an evildoer, a person who has done cruel and brutal deeds. One pure at heart has evermore the feast of spring, the holy day. One fair in act, one pure in heart, brings his virtue to perfection. It is here that you should bathe, to make yourself a refuge for all beings. And if you speak no falsehood, nor work harm for living beings, nor take what is offered not, with faith and free from avarice, what need for you to bathe in the sacred rivers? So you make yourself a refuge for all beings when you're pure in heart. So it's a nice idea. So the Buddha, this is his response to this Brahmin. So in the sutta then also is kind of a part of this discussion about becoming pure. The Buddha gives a simile of the cloth. And he says that if you have a cloth that is defiled and stained, then if you take a dye and try to dye it for the color, it won't take the dye properly. It'll go all kind of messed up because of the oils and the grime and the dirt there. And so you don't get the nicely colored cloth. But if the cloth is clean and, you know, completely white and clean, then it'll take the dye well. So, and you get a beautiful cloth. And so this is, he's kind of comparing it to the mind, that there's a difference between a mind which is caught up in its attachments, its torments, its defilements, its you know, all kinds of stuff, And when the mind is preoccupied and caught in those things, it can't really do a good job at taking in the path of freedom, can't really take in hearing the Dharma, can't really take in the work of purification that this path is about. And so the idea of becoming pure enough to do the work is part of the task here. So then he goes on, and he talks about the imperfections that defile the mind. Some people in the West don't like this kind of language, strong kind of negative language, but I think you're better off just going along with it for now, for these few minutes. And then he lists what 14, 16 different things which are imperfections that defile the mind. The scholar Bhikkhu Anālayo makes a very interesting comment about this list. He says these are social emotions or social defilements. They have to do with how we live in society with other people. And this is one of the themes in this little sutta, is how we live in the world with others. So you saw it already with being a refuge for all beings. So Versa is going to list Buddha lists this wonderful list. Covetousness, greed, ill will, anger, resentment, contempt, insolence, envy, avarice, deceit, fraud, obstinacy, rivalry, conceit, arrogance, vanity. It's a great list. So I hope you don't have too many of them or any of them, but maybe some of them occasionally will come to you. So this is where it gets more interesting. Knowing that these list of things, these individual things, are imperfections that defile the mind. Or if we want to say it in other terms, knowing that these things, when they occur in our minds, they hurt. They hurt. It's painful to have them. When they're in our minds, we tend to be like a cloth that's stained, and we can't really see clearly, we can't think clearly sometimes, and our relationship to the world is not clear. They're kind of a drag to have these things, to have, especially if we're caught in the grip of them. And we sometimes make terrible mistakes when we're caught in the grip of them. So that maybe says it a little bit nicer than saying, you know, imperfections that defile the mind. I think the word defile literally in Pali means torment. Recognizing that these things are a drag. So it requires some recognition. So you step back enough, you're clear enough that, you know, wait a minute, this, I've been doing this for a long time, this hurts. I'm sick and tired of being angry, I'm sick and tired of being afraid, I'm sick and tired of wanting all the time, being greedy, and whatever it might be. Then a person abandons it, lets go, as if it's easy just to do it, right? But, you know, sometimes it takes a while to do, and it's a whole path to let go of these things. But what he's describing here is a process. He's just mentioning that at some point they let go. They abandon it. And so this is where the next part comes in, where he talks about this confidence born from knowledge, based on knowledge, or trust, faith based on knowledge. When a person has known any of these imperfections that defile the mind, so you know you've had these things, and the person has abandoned them, he then acquires faith based on knowledge. And then he acquires unwavering confidence. So one of the things it's saying is that there's a kind of confidence or faith or trust that comes from your own experience, and a particular kind of experience. And the experience is that to go from a state of being tormented or troubled or feel a state which is not very optimal to have, and to let go of that and experience the mind without that, experience the heart without it. That movement is very, very significant because it teaches us something. It teaches us, for one thing, it teaches us it's not inherent in to the mind or the heart to have these defilements, have these movements there. They come and go. Sometimes they're there, sometimes they're not there. And if they're not inherent, are they required? If they're not constant, do we have any role to play? Can we live a life in such a way that we diminish how often they revisit? When we abandon them, we experience a mind without them, that's free of them. And this sutta says gives a particular kind of confidence. And the confidence based on knowledge that it describes, it says, the person then acquires confidence based on knowledge in the Buddha in the following way. The Buddha is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime knower of worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened and blessed. So it's a big leap to feel your mind free of anger and to realize that the Buddha is this great guy, great realized person. But I think that it's pointing to something about our own experience, something that's maybe relatively ordinary, that gives us a hint, a taste of what it's possible for a human being to attain, to accomplish, the way to be. That teaches us something about the nature of the Buddha. And maybe for us in modern world, we wouldn't use this kind of superlative language to describe that. But it's maybe something really inspiring that you get a hint in your own mind. So, wow, this is possible. And this person it's possible for someone to really do this thoroughly and fully. And this becomes an inspiration, something you have confidence in. Yes, not because you're confident in the Buddha, but because the Buddha, in this regard, is supposed to be a mirror for what you can do. You also can purify your mind. You also can move in this, become more thoroughly in this, liberated in this way. And then the person then acquires unwavering confidence, faith based on knowledge, in the Dharma. Thus, the Dhamma is well proclaimed. It's visible here and now, immediately effective, inviting inspection, onward leading, to be experienced by the wise for themselves. It's a great list of ways of describing the Dharma. You know, it means that you don't find the Dharma in this big book like that because it's not very visible right now. You have to go through all these pages in the book. And I don't know how inviting inspection this book is for some of you. You know, here and now, in your own experience, immediately effective, immediately beneficial, inviting you to look more carefully. Look at this world. Look at your experience. Onward leading. As you practice, you know, that it's not just a matter of being mindful and present so you can suffer better. It's to be mindful and present so that you can, there's onward leading path and progress, so you can move on a path to increasing freedom, peace. And to be experienced by the wise for themselves. So we don't want to keep it here in the book. We don't want to keep it as something, it's just a faith that we believe and inspired by. We want to have enough faith and confidence that we walk this path because this is something we can experience. And part of the devotion to being here and now, because here is where we're going to experience it. Here and now is where it's going to open up for us and where the onward leading is. And one acquires unwavering confidence in the Sangha. The Sangha is practicing the good way, practicing the straight way, practicing the true way, practicing the proper way. So there's something about your reference point of what happens in your own mind that gives you a hint of what the Buddha, Dharma, the Sangha is about. And then it's a matter then of continuing to do this inner work to cultivate and develop yourself further. Not to have blind devotion to those three. So then it goes on and says, when a person has let go and abandoned and relinquished the imperfections of the mind in part, I love this part here, in part. You know, so I don't know how little part you get let go of. Sometimes I feel like, well, that was a small part. That was pretty small, but at least it's something. And but the idea is in part, because there's more work to be done, but to appreciate however little you've done, however little you've managed to disentangle yourself from being caught up and lost and in your desires, addictions, hates, fears, you've stepped back from it all. And then it says here, the person considers that they have this confidence, trust, faith, based on knowledge in the Buddha Dharma Sangha. At that point, realizing you have this faith, this confidence, gladness arises connected to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. This is the word pamoja that Lee talked about. So from your own experience, you know something wonderful, and you have the example of the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha that shows that this is actually a way forward. Now that you've tasted something, experienced something, there's a way forward to move into this new world more fully and completely. And isn't this great? Considering this, gladness arises. And it seems in this text that the Buddha kind of expects that it's going to be automatic. Most people I know, it's not so automatic. I think that it's not so automatic because the trust is not so deep. And we don't have a habit or don't have a custom of really appreciating the goodness in our life, the good things that are happening for us, how fortunate we are. There's a way of sometimes of the way our thinking is, and this is why that part of the exercise of thinking was we're so involved in our thoughts, so involved in our concerns and our evaluations and our that, you know, it's hard to take it in, you know, the joy and the delight, the wonderfulness of having faith, having a path, having a practice, having a community. And so it's hard to feel the delight of that through the obscurations of, you know, all the stuff that we're concerned with and wanting and doing. But to relax and enjoy, appreciate, be glad, be nourished, by take the time to be nourished. There's so much to feel happy about and a lot to feel unhappy about. But we have some choice in the matter. It's possible to kind of look around and feel the goodness of the moment. And I think that generally the retreat center and people practicing here, this is in the scale of that goes on in the world. There's a lot of goodness here and now. And to kind of look around and appreciate you've in a field of goodness and feel delight in that, feel gladness in it. If you've had ever some experience of stepping away from your entanglements, or something you trouble you is no longer troubling you now, if you have the hindrances and they're no longer here, the hindrances go away, the instructions is to recognize that absence. And in that recognition of that absence, appreciate that. Allow the gladness to arise that you're no longer caught in the hindrances, caught up anymore. And I know, watching in my own mind, it's sometimes I forget to do that. Because I have important things to do, important things to think about, important troubles to resolve, you know, all kinds of things. It's so silly as I could, for example, finally be caught up in some big concern and feel irritated and something, and then, you know, the irritation goes away, and I don't take any time to appreciate this new state of ease or freedom I have, because I'm now concerned about getting the oil changed in my car, and it's so important, and what a drag, and the oil, and this and that, and you know, I'm on to the next thing, and on to the next thing. Are you always on to the next thing? Or can you appreciate what's here? So this gladness, having a faith, having had something. Do you have anything? Have you had anything in your life experience, in your practice experience, that gives you any sense, any intuitive sense or hint or experience of a mind that's free of the hindrances, or free of entanglements, or free of defilements? Do you have any experience of a mind which has gotten still, or peaceful, or at ease, or spacious, serene? Do you have anything, some hint of that? And if you do, is there some way that you can use that as a reference point that inspires you? It inspires you so there's a kind of a, you're delighted, you're glad, you're happy. And then, much like how Lee said, that goes on from there, it says, when one is glad, rapture is born. Rapture arises. In one who is rapturous, the body becomes tranquil. The way it's described, it's almost like automatic. These things just follow one after the other. And I like this idea that there's first gladness, and then there's rapture or pity. And the next step is the body calms down. The importance of letting the body relax and become tranquil can't be overemphasized. And one whose body is tranquil feels pleasure. The word is sukha. Some people prefer to translate that as happiness. And one who feels pleasure, the mind becomes concentrated. So that's nice. But then it goes on from there. And so what Lee does when he talks, when his reference point for the same process is the first jhana. That's what he talked about today. And then from there you go on to the next jhanas. This text has a little different next step that doesn't have to be different, but it's not obviously the jhanas, but I suspect it is. Having become concentrated, the person then abides, pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth, so above, below, around, and everywhere, to all as to oneself, one abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. And then it goes through the same thing with sympathetic joy, altruistic joy, compassion, and equanimity. So these are deep states of concentration that are probably the jhanic states. But the flavor of the jhanic states, the focus of jhanic states, are loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And the way it describes it here is a little bit of a natural unfolding. There's gladness, there's joy, there's tranquility arises, there's happiness, there's concentration. And with that concentration comes love, comes compassion. And not everyone experiences this, but I certainly have. I've been very surprised by the experiences of love and compassion that seems to come in the wake of sitting down, being still, and opening up, letting go of all the kind of clouds, and I call it the crusts over my heart, all the kind of finally settle in. It seems like there's some real goodness inside of us that, given a chance, will kind of sing, the heart will sing, and this beautiful qualities of love and compassion come. And to have it become boundless and open with all directions, because the mind is boundless and open, is one of the great things to experience. So there's three ways in the sutta, which talks about a path to liberation. It talks about it in relationship to the world of relationships we live in. It talks about becoming a refuge for all beings. It talks about the emotions or reactions we have that have a very much of a social context. Envy or being jealous or having conceit are all kind of social relationships, all how we live in relationship to other people. It's one of the primary ways in which we get entangled and caught in our emotional life, is the emotions that have to do with comparing ourselves or being involved with other people. And even sometimes when we get caught up in ourselves, it's often we treat ourselves as another person. And then the third way it has a social context for these teachings is this Brahma-vihara practice, which is, you know, spreading love and compassion and joy throughout the world. Beautiful thing to do. And in this way, the practice that we're doing is not a practice we do just for ourselves, but it's a practice we do for the benefit of all beings everywhere. And for me, it's hard to imagine that anybody can get very far doing this practice if they're just doing it for themselves. I think there's a kind of natural way in which we do it for others as much as we do it for ourselves, whether we know it or not. So to end this talk and to try to tie it to that guided exercise I did before, that a couple of things about that exercise. One is I think it's useful, as I said, to explore, get to understand your thinking better than maybe some of you have understood it before, so you can not be so caught by it. So you can let go of it easier and let go of it more effectively. Because if we don't understand it well, there's going to be a lot of momentum in our thinking that momentum will just kind of churn up more thoughts. But if you really have taken a time to look at it and see it and understand it well, all the component parts of it, and to step back like you step back from a movie in a movie theater, step back from the images you have, step back from the inner voice that's speaking, listen to the inner voice as if you're listening to someone speaking a foreign language you don't understand. And what's the tone of the voice? Where's the location of it? All this kind of stuff helps you to step back and away from it so you're not so entangled and involved in it. And as you step back and not so involved, it's easier to let it go. But also, it might be that some things you don't let go of completely, they still continue, but you have a sense that there's a way of being, there's a sense of the mind or awareness being distinct from what it's aware from. And that knowing mind, that aware mind, is peaceful or easeful or free or clear. And it's one of the ways to get a sense of what the Buddha was talking about here. There's a reference point of peace or ease, reference point of being awake or being clear, that gives you a foretaste of what it's like to be fully awake or fully peaceful. It gives you a hint, suggestion, of what others have experienced as well who've walked this path. It gives you a sense of what the Buddha, who did it much more thoroughly than probably most of us will ever do, but an inspiring way, an example of what's possible. And it hopefully can give rise to an inspiration, to faith, confidence, that then in return, we take the time, we allow ourselves the time, we allow ourselves to settle in and feel the pamoja, the joy or the delight, the gladness, the fortune of our faith, of our experience, of our life, of our practice, of having a path. Relax into that. Settle into that. Let it nourish you. So it becomes easier to be present. So it's easier to allow this delight, this joy, to well up and then become a reference point and a support for you to be more and more in the present moment, more concentrated, more present, more here. And this wonderful biofeedback system that Lee talked about. Settle in. Allow these experiences. Allow this, whatever little hints you have of gladness, delight, well-being, whatever is there, let it be a support to keep you here, keep you present, keep you going, and so it can grow and develop. And so that you can become a refuge for yourself and for all beings. So sometimes it's a custom here at IRC to end the talks with a minute or so of just coming back into your meditation posture to kind of help with that transition back into kind of the practice mode.